You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Greece has a new government as of this afternoon, but such has been the state of Greek politics in the last year, it doesn't seem too soon to ask for how much longer. We'll survey the present and future of men's fashion from the unimprovable vantage point of the Pitiuomo event in Milan.
It is the place that people go to kind of take the temperature of the industry. It's a place that you can get a pretty good forecast of what's going to happen in the season ahead.
We'll continue our tour of the cities named the world's most livable in the new Quality of Life issue of Monocle magazine. Tonight, it's the turn of the silver medalist. We'll have the latest on Julian Assange's impromptu squatting of the Ecuadorian embassy in London.
Well, there's a little room in the back, and there's an electric mattress with a little pump, and the pump goes, and the mattress expands, and it's a single little single bed, and he sleeps on that, I think.
We'll examine the entrails of this week's G20 conference, and we'll have another dispatch from our foreign editor's Adriatic road trip. All of that, plus some music too, coming up in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House. But before all that, the world headlines with Roger Crisp.
In London today, the Burmese pro-democracy campaigner Aung San Suu Kyi gave a speech in the Houses of Parliament. In recent times, only world figures have done so, and she is the first woman from abroad and the first Asian citizen to do so.
And so I'm here, in part, to ask for practical help. Help as a friend and an equal. In support of the reforms which can bring better lives, greater opportunities to the people of Burma who have been for so long deprived of their rights and their place in the world.
A Syrian Air Force pilot who defected to Jordan, landing his MiG-21 fighter plane at a military airbase in the northern city of Mafraq, has been granted asylum, Jordan's Minister of Information confirmed. The defection is the first involving an aircraft since the start of the uprising against President Bashar al-Assad, although thousands of soldiers have deserted from the Syrian army. A court in Jakarta convicted a militant today for making the bombs that killed 202 people at Bali nightclubs in 2002 and sentenced him to 20 years in prison. This was the final trial of those responsible for Indonesia's worst ever terror attack. Umar Patek was found guilty on all six charges at a court surrounded by snipers and bomb defusal experts. The new Greek Prime Minister Antonis Samaras has announced his new cabinet, made up mainly of Conservative Party members, technocrats and academics. All three parties in the coalition support the EU and IMF bailout but want to renegotiate its terms. Thanos Veremis, political history professor from the Hellenic Foundation for European and Foreign Policy, says he's not sure that more time to pay the country's debts would be a good thing.
If we do get an extension, that would mean there will be more recession for a longer time. So it's a no-win situation, really. If we do it the hard way, if it's a kind of shock therapy, the patient may die in the process or he may feel very bad. If there is an extension of his agony, he will still feel the agony of recession longer.
A senior Greek opposition Syriza party official said that the new government would not last and was primarily made up of politicians of the past who would not be able to stick to promises. Russian President Vladimir Putin sought to reassure investors today that he is committed to building a new economy through liberal reforms and privatization. He said he would not let protest against his rule spill over into civil unrest. But in his first big speech to investors since his return to the Kremlin in May, Putin offered nothing new. Commentators are not necessarily convinced he will do any more to carry out promises of economic and political reforms in this new six-year term than in his last 12 years as Russia's state leader. In Kuwait, more than half the members of parliament have resigned. The protest is at a court's decision to annul an election that had given the Islamist-led opposition a majority. The resignations deepen the political crisis in the major oil exporter, which has so far avoided the widespread dissent that has ousted heads of state in some other Arab countries. Wednesday's ruling effectively dissolved the parliament, elected in February, and reinstated its predecessor. And that's the news at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Roger. It's coming up for 6 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozhalovat, Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Dette Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det her Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. Now, Antonis Samaras, Greece's fourth prime minister in 8 months, named his cabinet today. If the most pessimistic of observers are to be believed, it's an announcement akin to Captain Edward Smith naming a new crew of the Titanic at around the point that the first funnel slips beneath the surface. What optimism that might remain is not encouraged by the revelation that the coalition partners of Samaras's New Democracy Party have already declared themselves reluctant to fully participate in the government. So joining me now to wonder how long we have until the next Greek election is Dr. Vasilis Monastiriotis of the Hellenic Observatory at the London School of Economics. Good evening.
Good evening. Hi.
First of all, what is going on with the stance of the PASOK and Democratic Left parties in the coalition here? They have two-party officials in the cabinet, including the new foreign minister, but they won't let their MPs participate.
Indeed, it seems that both parties, PASOK, the centre-left, and the Democratic Left, the third party in the coalition, they didn't want to be too much identified with the government, and they didn't want to have the political members, MPs, participating in the government. But of course, this creates big questions about the agreement among the parties in the coalition, but also the effectiveness of the government to communicate the different positions of the parties.
That's not terrifically encouraging as a start, though, is it?
I cannot say it is, yes. It is problematic. I think there is an issue there. If the voices of the two minor coalition parties are not represented in the cabinet, then how will policy formulation take place and how will it be a synthesis of the different opinions? If there is a different forum outside the cabinet that actually does this deliberation, where the other parties can put forward the proposals and negotiate policies with the centre-right New Democracy Party, the main party of the coalition, if there is this other forum, then what will be the relationship between this other forum and the cabinet? Will the cabinet be somehow compromised and delegitimized from that?
One of the more obviously significant appointments of Mr. Samaras's new cabinet is Vasilis Rapanos as the new finance minister. Now, he's the former chairman of the National Bank of Greece. Yeah. But as such, how much blame does he bear for Greece's current problems?
I don't think much. He is quite a recent appointment, so he's not associated with the bank for the governance of the bank, and this is not the Central Bank of Greece. This is the main publicly owned commercial bank in Greece, the National Bank of Greece. But it is a big player. So the bank is a big player in the Greek banking market. However, Rapanos has a very good service at the university as a professor at the university, and also formerly at the Center for Planning, for Economic Planning in Greece. So he knows the economy very well, and he has been, not very vocal, but he has been for years identifying the weaknesses, especially with the tax system and the tax collection, but also the tax system more generally.
Well, that's an interesting point you mentioned there, because I guess one of the frustrations of this government and of previous Greek governments is that how much is it the case that the Greek people keep looking to the Greek governments to solve Greece's problems, but they're not actually willing to participate in that process themselves? They're not upholding their end of the social contract, if you like, by paying taxes, retiring later rather than earlier, and that kind of thing.
Yes. Well, tax evasion, to which you allude, is indeed a big problem. And it is a problem at many different scales. It is not, if you want, one problem. It is a problem at the very low incomes. It is a coping strategy because people cannot afford to pay taxes, mostly people who are in self-employment, and thus it's difficult for the government to identify the actual incomes. But there's huge tax evasion and tax avoidance, actually, also at much higher, at the other side of the scale, on the very high incomes. And the form of tax evasion there is what actually creates also the antipathy for any new tax measures, because this is sort of visible tax evasion that people at lower incomes do not identify with. And they use this to justify their own tax evasion. So I think improving the efficiency and the functioning of the tax collection system will actually go a long way to changing also, if you want, the mentality of how conscientious Greeks feel about paying their taxes.
So basically, is the situation that poorer people don't see why they should pay taxes if rich people aren't paying them?
Absolutely. Of course, how each one of us defines themselves as poor or not poor, depending on whether they are to pay taxes or to collect transfers, is a different situation.
Okay, well, so once Antonis Samaras has got everybody sat down around the cabinet table, what do you think should be at the top of his first agenda? What does he need to do first?
I think the first thing that needs to be done is to find a way for some money to come to the real economy, so some investment funds to come to the economy. This is partly the job of the European Union in allocating, releasing the funds, but also partly the job of the Greek government in actually absorbing the funds. We have a big problem there. And the other important thing is to do something with acute poverty. We have a significant decline in incomes across the board in Greece over the last 3, 4, 5 years. But we also have people who are thrown in acute poverty. They do not have any medical insurance, any income support, no job, nothing. So I think something must be done there. And I'm afraid that on this last issue, I haven't heard any debate about the programmatic positions of the new government. This is what they need to do, of course, at home. What they need to do in relation to the Eurozone partners is to come up with some very, very concrete and convincing proposals about how are they going to implement the reforms and do the policies that the previous governments promised but were unable to deliver, how they will be different compared to the previous government.
And just finally, and I know it's very, very difficult to make predictions about Greek politics at the best of times, and that this is very far from the best of times, but how long do you think Mr. Samaras's new government will last? Will Greece be having another election before, say, Christmas?
Yeah, some people mention October as the end date of this government. I'm a bit more, I'm much more optimistic, actually. I think this government has 2 years to try and turn the situation around. If it starts slowly, if it is not very successful, it would face huge opposition. But we do not really have many alternatives. And the last two rounds of elections showed that you know, there's not much support for the memorandum and the austerity measures, but also the counter-austerity, the anti-memorandum proposal is not really convincing the people. So even if there is strong opposition to this government, I don't think the political parties will actually take the country to a new round of elections, at least for a year's time.
Dr. Vasilis Monastiriotis of the Hellenic Observatory at the London School of Economics, thank you very much for joining me. You're listening to Midori House.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
This is Midori House, live from Studio One in London. Coming up next, we'll have the latest from Pitiuomo in Milan. But before that, this is Alessandra Amoroso with Ciao. That was Alessandra Amoroso with Ciao. The time is coming up for 19 minutes past 1800 hours here in London, and you're listening to Midori House. Now, twice a year, Florence is annexed by a fashion event, Pitiuomo, which hosts a vast convention of men's clothing and accessory collections. Monocle's business editor, Jonathan Openshaw, is there right now, and I spoke to him earlier. It's sunny, apparently.
Well, I never thought I was going to complain about being too hot after the kind of 12-month winter that we've had in the UK, but it's completely sweltering. It's a heat wave here, 38 degrees, and like not even a breath of wind, which sounds, it would be lovely if you were kind of laid out by a pool, but we're going from kind of interview to interview, event to event. I mean, last night we were at the Peter Pilotto launch, and it was in this like crazy Rococo Palazzo kind of place, and they had heat lamps everywhere because they were projecting Pilotto projections, and they had candles lit everywhere, and the candles were actually melting, not from the flames, but had just gone kind of wobbly through the heat. So it's intense.
I was actually going to ask, I was building up to a serious question whether that kind of those kind of conditions present actual logistical issues to people who are trying to run a fashion event, because presumably not everybody can just go around in shorts and t-shirts and sandals.
Well, this is the thing as well, and it is pity. So people come here to kind of, people are here to be see and be seen. So you have people walking around in three-piece suits with ties on in this kind of absolutely, so I've given up. I'm wearing espadrilles and shorts.
It sounds a little bit to me like what Sydney looked like in the late 1980s when goth caught on in Sydney. It wasn't a pretty sight. It went badly for people. The sort of fur and makeup and hair extensions and an Australian summer, lousy combination. But back to the subject at hand, what is it that makes pity a thing that people keep coming back to? How is it different from, I guess, something like Milan Fashion Week?
Well, I mean, it's the beginning of the season, firstly. So I mentioned before, it's the place that people go to be seen. And there's slightly more to that than just kind of narcissism. It is the place that people go to kind of take the temperature of the industry. It's a place that you can get a pretty good forecast of what's going to happen in the season ahead in the coming weeks. So in Milan this weekend and Paris the following weekend. And I mean, it's a real barometer, not just for the Italian menswear industry, which is obviously one of the kind of bigger brands within menswear internationally, but also it's a real cross section of everything that happens in menswear globally. So you've got your kind of Okayama denim weavers, you've got your buyers from South Korea, you've got your promotional Playboy bunnies from Italy. It's a kind of big heady mishmash of the whole industry. So I mean, not a lot, it's not necessarily known for where the buying happens. It's not the same kind of trading that happens in Milan or Paris being the end of the season, but it's the place that people really go to understand what's going on, what the kind of mood is.
Well, leaving aside the actual fashions, which we'll come to presently, what is the mood like from a business perspective? How confident and happy do people feel about launching and working at a fashion event given Italy's somewhat straitened economic circumstances?
Well, this is it. I mean, this is the question we've been asking everyone today. People are being very positive, not necessarily surprising since we're talking to the organisers and a lot of the brand owners. For me, it feels quieter than it's been before. Certainly, the Italian domestic market, from a buyer's perspective, has been really seriously dented. And the Italian market is a big factor in the kind of purchasing decisions at Pitti. Then again, pity is very international, and there are a really interesting mix of international buyers here. So if you kind of, I mean, if you look at brand Italy as an example, I'd say the domestic markets collapsed, and that's a really bad situation for a lot of the brands here, a lot of the quite small family-owned brands. But at the same time, you've got this quite kind of interesting rise in what brand Italy means abroad, and a real interest in recovering markets from USA to Japan, and also in new markets like China. So it is a story of two halves. Maybe you could kind of divide it between the business and the brand, and Italian brands are having a very interesting moment. I think Italian businesses are certainly struggling.
Well, to return to those Italian brands then, what among the actual wares on show has caught your eye?
Well, there's a couple. I mean, new launch is always interesting here, and people do, they put a lot of time and money into launching brands at Pitti. Like I said, this is where people go to leave their mark. So there's a new launch from, well, it's not new, it's a British brand, actually, called Barracuda, which is Manchester-based. And they were kind of, from the 1930s, they were the kind of the final word in Rain Max and outerwear, because it rains all the time in Manchester, obviously. But they were bought up last year, I believe it was, by Woolrich Woolen Mills, the kind of Italian giant who own a lot of brands within the umbrella. And they were relaunched to, we weren't actually here, it was on Tuesday evening, and they were relaunched to kind of much fanfare and pity. I think their event got 3,000 people attending. And so it's very much kind of breathing new life into this kind of British Mancunian brand. I think they flew out Giles Peterson and the guy who organised Notting Hill Carnival, and kind of made this quite, it's quite hilarious to kind of see how Britain is understood through the filter of Italian luxury and menswear, because it was all kind of scar and punk and golfing jackets. But yeah, I mean, so that was a very interesting new launch. I'm sure it'll do very well. They've got the Japanese designer Kenny Cassano on board, and he's redesigned the whole range. And then also a new launch, Hancock, who's from Daniel Dunko, who's formerly of Macintosh, and he kind of really defined Macintosh brand for the last 15, 20 years. Another outerwear offer. And so he left Macintosh last year, kind of took his 6 months non-competition period, and has now launched Hancock, which is really beautiful, everything, you know, made, sourced in Edinburgh, using design talent from Edinburgh University, a Royal Cross Scotland. And yeah, that's a really exciting new launch as well. So yeah, I mean, there are things happening, definitely.
And just finally, what's still to come at Pitti are you looking forward to seeing?
Well, straight after this, I am going to get changed out of my slightly sweaty day clothes and get into my evening outfit, and we're heading to the Carven show, which is at a velodrome, I believe. So I'm not quite sure what it's going to work, but anyway, I mean, there's two kind of catwalk shows. See, Pitti's not really known for catwalk; it's much more a menswear event. But there's two catwalk shows. Valentino was last night, and tonight is Carven. So we'll be heading over there, and then also I believe there's a Polimoda, which is the kind of design and fashion school here, headed by Linda Lopper, who used to be of design. I think she's at Antwerp before, and she's coming and really shaking things up at Polimoda, and she's hosting a kind of garden party. There's presentations there as well on what Polimoda's been doing and what it'll be doing next year, so we'll pop along for that as well.
And that was Monocle's business editor, Jonathan Openshaw, calling from Milan, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, since WikiLeaks founder and wanted fugitive Julian Assange invited himself into Ecuador's embassy in London on Tuesday evening and requested asylum, almost every journalist in explored space has expressed an opinion and or investigated the angles. Yesterday on Midori House, indeed, we had a most entertaining discussion with Professor John Quigley from Ohio State University about the legal practicalities of Assange's stunt. However, only one journalist has actually been into the embassy and spoken to the peroxide pimp. Gavin McFadyen, Director of the Centre for Investigative Journalism. Gavin talked to Andrew Tuck and Dominic Reynolds on this morning's edition of The Globalist.
I went to see him as early in the morning, and I found a very small and modest embassy with a very generous and kindly staff, and they pointed me to a small room in the back where he was.
And can I just ask you a few basics? They've had to put a camp bed up for him? Do they have a room for him to take over? So what's his setup there?
Well, there's a little room in the back, and there's an electric mattress with a little pump, and the pump goes, and the mattress expands, and it's a single little single bed, and he sleeps on that, I think. But, I mean, it's not exactly the most lugubrious and wonderful circumstances.
And what was his mood?
Very good, actually, surprisingly. I think the papers made a great deal of the shock of it, and I think all of us who knew him were shocked that it had been done. But the reason why we were shocked was simple. Had any of us been alerted at first that he was going to do it, we would be liable under the law. And so to preclude the possibility of any of his surators or security holders from being arrested, he didn't tell anybody.
On the shabbier side of it, people would think he just won't go back to Sweden to face up to these charges.
Well, I think, you know, anybody looking at those charges and what he might do in jail time worried to be convicted of them. Because actually there are no charges, there are only allegations. I mean, that's one of the extraordinary facts of this. He's been held in for 500 days in house arrest conditions, wearing an ankle bracelet and all the rest of it, limited movement. But he's never been charged with anything by any country, anywhere. So his situation is unique. And I think that most of the lawyers involved in Sweden in his case that I've spoken to take the view that if he got put a jail sentence, it would be 2 weeks, a month, maybe 2 months at the absolute outside. And 2 months in a relatively luxurious Scandinavian jail would be very different than 55 years in a Texas prison. And I think that's the fear that he had, the fear of extradition. So I don't think it's so much a conspiracy as a reality problem. The Americans have now admitted that a secret grand jury in the state of Virginia exists entirely to find laws in which they can put him away. And they've been unsuccessful after a year, but they're still going at it. And they're seeing witnesses taking statements and all the rest of it. So the Assange's lawyers are actually at that hearing itself. And this has not been reported here. It's reported in Sweden. Everybody knows about it in Sweden and the United States. The New York Times has reported it, but not here. So I think it sounds like a conspiracy to say, oh, he'll be locked up in some horrible place. But the truth is, that's a real danger. Look what happened to Bradley Manning. I mean, he's had 57 years piled on top of him for an offense that is barely an offense.
Is he scared? You're suggesting of what could happen were he to end up in, say, a Texan jail.
Anybody in their right mind would be fearful of those conditions where you've got to understand in American jails, they have the highest rate of murder in the world in the States. And it's a real problem. And his lawyers are even more maniac about this than he is.
That was Gavin McFadgen, director of the Center for Investigative Journalism, talking about his visit with Julian Assange on this morning's Globalist. You can hear the whole interview and yesterday's discussion on Midori House by using the time shift feature on the Monocle 24 website or downloading the episodes from iTunes. It's just gone 18:30 here in London, and you're listening to Midori House.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozhalovat, Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 this.
Det är Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll visit the city that Monocle magazine has just declared the world's second most livable. But first, the news headlines with Roger Crisp.
Thanks, Andrew. In London today, the Burmese pro-democracy campaigner Aung San Suu Kyi gave a speech in the Houses of Parliament. In recent times, only world figures have done so, and she is the first woman from abroad and the first Asian citizen to do so. A Syrian Air Force pilot who defected to Jordan, landing his MiG-21 fighter plane at a military airbase in the northern city of Mafraq, has been granted asylum. A court in Jakarta convicted a militant today for making the bombs that killed 202 people at Bali nightclubs in 2002 and sentenced him to 20 years in prison. This was the final trial of those responsible for Indonesia's worst ever terrorist attack. The new Greek Prime Minister, Antonis Samaras, has announced his new cabinet, made up mainly of Conservative Party members, technocrats and academics. All three parties in the coalition support the EU and IMF bailout, but want to renegotiate the terms. Russian President Vladimir Putin sought to reassure investors today that he is committed to building a new economy through liberal reforms and privatization. He said he would not let protests against his rule spill over into civil unrest. And in Kuwait, more than half the members of parliament have resigned. The protest is at a court's decision to annul an election that had given the Islamist-led opposition a majority. And those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Roger. All this week on Midori House, we've been visiting the cities which the new quality of life issue of Monocle has deemed the world's most livable. Tonight, we're going to the second place getter and last year's winner, Helsinki. And to elaborate on the delights of the Finnish capital, we're joined on the line by Monocle contributor Lisu Moulton and live in the studio by Monocle's token Finn, Marcus Hippi. Lisu, to come to you first, because you're in Helsinki, why do you think Helsinki lost the title?
Why do I think it lost the title? That's a good question. I don't know. I have to say, I think there are so many great reasons why Helsinki is a wonderful place to live. So I don't know the answer to that. Why do you think we lost the title?
I don't know. Given that the winner was Zurich at the risk of courting controversy, I mean, of course, I would have voted for Melbourne or Sydney because that's where I come from. But Helsinki, I was wondering if you could sort of tell us a bit about your relationship with Helsinki, how you came to live there and how you found it as a place to adjust to.
Yeah, well, I've been living in Finland now for 23 years, which actually makes me sound way older than I actually am. So don't believe that I'm that old, that I could possibly have been living somewhere for that long. But, you know, the main thing about Helsinki, I think, is that it's a really easy place to live. I mean, I'm from New York personally, and I know in London everybody complains that life is kind of, it's a struggle, you know? I mean, people are really working really hard, it's really expensive to live, and it's kind of more of a struggle, but Helsinki is a very, very laid-back place to live, and a very, very livable city, I would say.
Marcus, you're somebody who gave up that livable Scandinavian haven to come and join the struggle here in London. What do you miss about Helsinki?
Actually, I realised to value Helsinki so much higher after moving away from there, after spending 10 years in there. You don't realise how much free time you can have when you live in Helsinki. My working day is finished at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I would cycle home for 10 minutes, and I didn't even live close to the office. And for the rest of the day, I would be wondering what to do with all my free time. I miss that. I miss parks. I miss the simplicity of living in a small city. I miss the community feeling you get over there. When you walk on the streets, you actually recognise quite a few people and you miss your friends.
So what do you do? We'll come back to you, Lisu, in Helsinki, with your spare time in Helsinki. What are your options?
There are a lot of options, and that I definitely agree with Marcos that there is such a small town feeling here, but it really is, I mean, it is a big city, there's everything you need, but it's true that you really do, I mean, you never go downtown without running into somebody, at least one person that you know, which is kind of, I mean, that's a cool thing. And I guess part of that is that the city itself is pretty, the downtown area is pretty small, but there are tons of things to do. I mean, there are tons of course, culture and design are huge things here. So there are, you know, museums for everything you can imagine and all sorts of galleries, little galleries in various neighborhoods throughout the city. And there's always something going on in that respect. And then, of course, this is a fun city, too. People like to go out. Finns are notorious for, you know, knowing how to have a good time. So there are lots of great bars and nowadays lots of great food restaurants. I mean, Helsinki used to get a very bad rap about the food, but these days there are a lot of really, really great restaurants.
I have to say, I noticed that, by the way, when I was in Helsinki just 3 weeks ago. During less than 1 year, something has obviously happened over there. Helsinki seems to be blossoming with new restaurants and new bars.
Definitely.
Marcus, to come back to you here, I mean, what do you think there's one thing about Helsinki that other cities, maybe, say, London, could learn from Helsinki? What's something that we should adopt?
It's something that I don't have the answer for that question, but there's something about the working life that is very special up there in the north. I don't know why it seems that you need to work so many hours in so many countries abroad when you could actually do all the things in a shorter time. Finns don't work that many hours a week, but actually Finland is a very competitive country. And I don't know why that is. That is something I've been actually wondering for the whole of the time I've been living in London.
Lisu, what do you think's their secret?
I think it's about the, it comes down to the, this is a very, you really do get a feeling, especially if you live here. I'm sure also if you visit, but definitely if you live here, this is a very, very welfare-oriented country, and people are interested in other people's well-being. And I think that nobody would, or very few people would be willing to work the kind of hours that people work in London and New York. And there's always the feeling in those places that you're kind of, you know, if you take vacation even for a week, somebody's going to come and steal your job, or you never know what's going to happen, or you have to do, you know, really be part of the grind. But here it's like, you know, people have a right to take vacation. I mean, it's, you know, summer vacation actually is starting this weekend because it's midsummer. So people take 5 weeks of vacation, and that's the norm. I mean, the whole country shuts down basically in July.
That's the humor. I lived there, and I was working for 4 days a week. I was working for 30 hours a week. That's a bit less even than the normal. I was getting the salary of 13 months, and I would take 5 weeks off, and I would feel completely, utterly tired.
Well, staying with you, Marcus, I guess, to invert the question I asked you a few minutes ago, what don't you miss about Helsinki? What could it do better? How can it get its number one spot back?
I know Lisa would want to say that Helsinki is not a great tourist destination if you wanted to spend there, you know, time. I think Helsinki is brilliant for a long weekend, but if you live there for 8, 9, 10 years, I feel that it's not that... There's not that much happening over there in the long run. When you've been there for years and years and years, it doesn't necessarily inspire you that much. But I have to, by the way, remind us all that there are two monocle fixes that are given for Helsinki on the latest edition of the magazine, and they are that Helsinki should be more experimental when it comes to the architecture. There's the new music hall in there. And even in Finland, it's been criticized for looking like a shopping mall, supermarket, and it actually looks like one. And secondly, Helsinki should have more small hotels. If you go there for a trip, it's quite probable that you'd end up living in a chain hotel.
And Lisa, just very briefly from you, what's one improvement you'd like to see?
Those are good ideas, actually. One thing, if I can say one more thing that's wonderful about the city, it's definitely the transportation, the public transportation, compared to a lot of other cities. I mean, again, going back to New York, which is where I'm from, and I'm sure a lot of listeners have been to New York. If you, for example, have children, have a little child, it's very hard to get around in New York. Where here, it's really brilliant. There's, you know, it's very easy to get anywhere you're going.
Indeed, indeed. It's something you actually get a good, very good perspective if you move away from there. And it's very educational for Finns to leave the country as well, to have an idea of what a great city it is.
Monocle's contributor in Helsinki, Lizzie Moulton, and here in Studio One, Monocle producer Marcus Hippi. Thank you both very much. And for our next song, we thought we'd stay in Finland. We'll hear a track from a new album by a new Finnish artist. And so both the artist and the title are pronounced correctly. It's over to Marcus.
Oh, it's Beemäpe, actually not quite new, been around for a few years. And this song is Heliumpallo.
Marcus has now left the studio and left me to try and back announce this one on my own, so I'm going to have a crack at it. That was Heliumpallo by Peempepe. Peempepe? Near enough? I'm getting a thumbs up. I'll take that. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture. From the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand. To sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
What does Mexico make you think of? Drugs, kidnappings, tequila and more drugs? Or how about a thriving economy, innovative business leaders, world-beating art, and the best in hospitality, and a rather good quality of life? As Mexicans prepare to elect a new president on July the 1st, next week on Monocle 24, we'll be going beyond the headlines and the stereotypes. We'll reveal a nation that international brands are desperate to crack, and where politics is vibrant and vital. We'll also reveal why you should put down that tequila as we investigate the Mezcal revival. Join us for Monocle's week-long Mexican survey on The Globalist and The Daily. Mexico 2012, next week on Monocle 24.
And on the subject of Mexico, the world's leaders gathered at this week's G20 summit in Los Cabos, Mexico, have once again been regarding the global economy with the air of men standing around a broken-down car. They've been talking in terms which suggest knowledge incompetence in the hope that this will disguise the fact that they haven't the foggiest idea how to make the thing start again. Well, joining me now is Jonathan Portes, Director of the National Institute of Economic and Social Research. Good evening, Jonathan.
Good evening.
At the G20 in London a couple of years ago, the G20 then agreed to this massive coordinated fiscal stimulus, after which the UK's then Prime Minister Gordon Brown claimed to have saved the world. Why does the world still appear to be unsaved?
Well, unfortunately, as you said, the G20 in London in April 2009 came in a time of a real sense of crisis, and that led to a real sense of purpose among leaders, and they managed to agree on things which normally they would never have agreed on, not just the fiscal stimulus, but extra money for the IMF, reforms of financial regulation, and all the rest of it. And it worked. It had a massive impact on confidence across the globe. Unfortunately, in some sense, it may have worked too well, because the result was, a year later, when the G20 leaders gathered in Toronto, they sort of declared, well, you know, everything's sort of back on track now. What we've got to do now is cut spending, fiscal austerity, we'll sort of slow pedal financial reform, and so on. And so they really took their eye off the ball, or indeed took their eye off the ball and put it on a completely different ball, and what turned out to be the wrong ball of premature austerity before the recovery had been firmly established. And in retrospect, I think it's now absolutely clear that was a serious strategic mistake at a global level, and we've been paying the price really for the last couple of years.
Well, it's the obvious question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. If the austerity doesn't work, why are people still doing it? Have we reached a point at which ideology is trumping utility?
Well, it is for some countries in some respects. Now, I think every country is different, and there still isn't quite yet that sense of complete crisis, which has forced them to bury their differences and come up with a coordinated plan. So what we have is, in the U.S., all eyes are on the presidential election, and the administration there, I think, has relatively sensible policies and knows what the right thing to do is, but has no prospect whatsoever of being able to do it before the election. Meanwhile, in the Eurozone, as we know, which is the center of the current crisis, the split is really between Northern Europeans led by Angela Merkel, who want to see austerity first and reform and financial flows afterwards. And the southern countries, which I think are recognizing the austerity programs that they signed up to, simply aren't deliverable. Meanwhile, we here in the UK have our own problems, an austerity program that has damaged the economy, and hence we're badly off track. And I think the government is beginning to wake up to that and has some ideas of how to get us out of that. But we're essentially preoccupied with our own problems. So while our prime minister does like to tell the Eurozone what to do, and actually, I think, to be honest, most of what he says is quite sensible, I don't think anyone's really listening.
I mean, as you see it, at least, of the current crop of G20 leaders, who are the ones who really get it and who are the ones that just don't?
Well, clearly, President Obama and his advisors, I think, do essentially get it. But unfortunately, they have an election to fight, and there is absolutely no prospect that the U.S., the Republican-controlled Congress, will allow them to do anything significant before the election. So there were some very sensible statements on the U.S. economy in the G20 leader statement. They're saying that the U.S. would not allow the very sharp fiscal contraction, which is now planned, to go ahead. But can the administration actually deliver that? That will depend on political events. So I think the U.S. administration does get it. And I think Monsieur Hollande in France, although some of his domestic policies on tax and spending are not ones that I personally think are very sensible from the point of view of France, I think he does understand at the Eurozone level what needs to happen, as does Mario Monti of Italy. Those are the people who I would say understand the what the crisis is about and what needs to be done.
What about the ones who you think are not getting it?
Well, As I said, I actually think that our Prime Minister, David Cameron, does have a reasonably good idea of what to do in what the Eurozone needs. And actually, he's not too far off saying what Monsieur Hollande and Mr. Monti are saying. But nobody's listening to him in the Eurozone. Meanwhile, domestically, the government has boxed itself in with some of its unfortunate rhetoric about the need for austerity, and it's made it difficult for it to do what needs to be done. I think the most important roadblock at the moment is Angela Merkel in Germany, where her strategy appears to be to do the minimum possible at the latest possible moment, and it is not clear to me that that is a sustainable strategy.
You spoke at the start of this interview about how at the 2009 G20 there was this extraordinary sense of collective purpose and solidarity prompted by a quite suddenly descending crisis. Is the problem now perhaps that the crisis has gone on so long that it started to feel normal, that people just feel like now this is just the weather we have to live with?
I think that certainly has had that part of it. There isn't quite that same sense of urgency or quite the same sense that we actually all need to come together and have a coordinated plan of action to get out of this. Now, it may be that if things get even worse at the Eurozone, that sense of collective purpose will be reestablished, because the potential consequences of a disorderly collapse of or breakup of the Eurozone are at least as bad as what we were facing in 2009.
Jonathan Portes, Director of the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, thank you very much for joining me. You're listening to Midori House. Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, over the last few days, Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield has been undertaking a less than arduous road trip, not that I'm bitter or anything, around the Northern Adriatic, taking in Croatia, Slovenia and Italy. And tonight he joins us from Trieste. Steve, good evening.
Good evening, Andrew. I'm standing in Piazza della Libertà here in the heart of Trieste. We arrived about an hour ago, thus completing our, can I say epic? I think I'm going to say epic. 500-kilometre drive from Zagreb across the Adriatic, and as you say, through Croatia, Slovenia, and now into Italy.
Are you still having an annoyingly good time then?
It's been very interesting, yeah. It's been quite good fun. We had this morning, we were in Piran, where I spoke to you from last night, and met some very interesting people at the Museum of Piran who were saying all sorts of things about the town's history, which I won't bore you with now, because I will be turning those into pearls of wisdom that will be in the actual article in the Mediterranean. And then we sort of worked our way up the coast through a town called Izola to Koper, which is the main port in Slovenia, and then over into Trieste. A couple of things we picked up along the way, quite interesting. One, Slovenian and Italian are spoken all along the Slovenian coast. Even most of the street signs are in Italian as well. There's a really strong historical Italian influence, but one that's still strong today. And the other is that being in the European Union has helped Slovenia enormously. They get visitors from all over that, frankly, weren't there 10 years ago.
Yeah, I was interested to know your impressions of Slovenia generally, because I was there late last year to write about Slovenia for the Alpino edition of Monocle. Did you get the impression that it was now becoming sort of more like just another country in Western Europe?
No, I think it's still got, you know, the charm that attracted people in the first place. And I think, you know, one of those advantages, as you just highlighted, you know, you can go skiing here, and yet you can also go to the Adriatic. One set of British tourists that we met this morning did look slightly worried, though, when they looked at the beach and said, the Germans are here. The word must have got out.
Those stereotypes do die rather hard. What are you looking for in Trieste?
That's a very good question. We're going to be exploring around tomorrow morning and see what we can find. I think I'm intrigued to see how Trieste has traditionally been a city that has made enormous use of its port and of where it sits within Europe. And I'm going to be intrigued to see sort of how it's changed as, you know, certainly things to the south have changed over the last 20 years, you know, from the former Yugoslavia to now Slovenia, and now also Slovenia that's strong and independent in the European Union.
I know I'd be asking you for your first impressions, your very first impressions, but earlier in tonight's show I spoke to Jonathan Openshaw, who's in Milan, and he was saying that among the sort of the fashionistas in Milan he'd been speaking to, there's a certain amount of anxiety about Italy's sort of economic woes. Is there any sort of sense of Italy being less carefree than usual?
Not so far, and I think what's interesting in Trieste as well, it's always been one of the richest regions in Italy, and still is to this day. It's got the port, it's got a huge amount of export as well, shipbuilding, they still build a lot of ships here, and then also financial services, which have survived the crash and still seem to be doing fairly well. So, first impressions, we'll see. By the end, I'm afraid I'm not doing a check-in with you tomorrow because by then I'll be at Stansted, which will be, frankly, less exciting. But you can certainly read the results in the new issue of Mediterraneo, which is coming out, I think, sometime towards the end of July.
And who are you hoping, just finally, who are you hoping to meet in Trieste while you're there?
Again, a very good question. that was some rather interesting local driving there you just heard.
Authentic Italian car horn.
Yes, we're meeting your usual mix of local journalists, business people, and if we have time before we get on the plane, maybe a politician or two as well.
Look forward to reading the results. Steve Bloomfield in Trieste, Monocle's foreign editor. Thank you very much for joining me. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And that's all for today's issue. Edition. See, I was talking about the Mediterraneo there with Steve, and I suddenly forgot which media I was working in. That's all for today's edition of Midori House. Thanks to producer Marcus Hippie, researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and studio manager Alex Jakes. Up next after the news is this week's episode of The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, who will be exploring the gentrification of Redchurch Street in London.
It's an area that is revitalizing itself while at the same time staying pretty true to those original roots, which I hope is what Sunspell's doing as well.
In 3 hours' time, that's 2200 hours here in London, Chloe Potter and Aisha Spears will be back for the Monocle Daily. Today they'll be wondering why Africa, despite growing 7% a year, is not yet Asia, and they'll ponder the future for Mexicana Airlines, among much else. If you've missed any of our programmes, you can hear everything on iTunes via our website or via our mobile app. Emma Barnett will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. I've been Andrew Muller. Thank you very much for listening. Good evening.